This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
So, Katie, as you're gnawing on your almond butter, we're here.
I'm having pretzels with almond butter because you wouldn't share your sandwich on the train. Not that I'm going to hold that against you,
Ryan. I offered both sandwiches, to be clear. But
anyway,
we're here on the north side of Capitol Hill, where an impromptu rally has begun with a bunch of Democratic senators protesting the health care bill that the Republicans are trying to pass through the Senate.
And they voted to discuss the health care bill, in essence,
right? They voted
on
a motion to proceed, which means that they can commence debate. And these
are so formal, Brian. They voted so they can discuss the bill.
They voted to start talking. Anyway, we shouldn't overlook. This is the 1 year anniversary of our podcast, Katie.
Oh, happy anniversary!
Happy anniversary to you too. And we're back where it all started on Capitol Hill.
That's right. One of our first podcasts was with Senator Al Franken, and we walked around the halls of Congress and talked to folks. And this was, of course, before the election.
Yes, this was in a
previous
universe.
And now here we are, 6 months into the Donald Trump presidency, with a lot of Democrats standing in front of the Capitol and basically talking about the need to preserve the Affordable Care Act.
And we spoke to a lot of people who are gathered here, mostly against what the Republicans are trying to do, but one or two Trump supporters as well.
We did hear from a lot of people who are extremely upset. For many of these people, it's a matter of life and death, and especially for those who have children with disabilities who rely on Medicaid for their care. There were a lot of very emotional people. Let's listen to what some of them had to say.
I have a son with Down syndrome. Sorry, I'm going to cry. And his future depends on Medicaid. With these cuts, it's really hard to see how he'll live independently and work. And that's why so many of us are here today, people with disabilities who rely on Medicaid simply to live.
Do you think this is going to make a difference to have people come out like this?
Definitely, because this cuts across party lines. Disability doesn't discriminate. There's millions of families with a member who relies on Medicaid because of a disability or an aging parent. I also have two of those. So, this is a real crisis for a lot of people in this country.
A lot of these people are here worried about what these changes will mean specifically to their disabled kids. Tell me how you're feeling about the whole debate.
I don't care.
You don't care?
I don't care.
About the debate or about them?
Just kind of just say I don't care. Whatever the president wants, I'm for. So I would say I'm for repeal and replace, and I'm not particularly concerned about how they replace it.
You know, the Congressional Budget Office, as I'm sure you probably have heard, estimates anywhere from 20 to 32 million people will lose their health care if Obamacare is repealed. And I'm curious how you feel about that.
Yeah, that would be real sad. That'd be sad.
But it's not enough for you to speak out against the president or this pending legislation.
No.
What medical conditions do you have?
I have cerebral palsy, and I just require in-home care, people to get me out of bed, help me do the things that everybody does to get ready for the day. And if services get cut with this health care bill, I would wind up in a nursing home. Our services like mine would be the first to go.
You walked all the way here to Washington?
Almost 400 miles, yeah.
Wow. To get them to hear her voice.
Just tell me about Lauren and why you're here representing her.
Well, she can't talk.
How old is Lauren?
9 years old. She'll never speak. She can't stand up. So I walk for her because she can't walk. And I stood up for her because she can't stand. And I speak for her because she can't speak. They need to leave children like her out of politics. This is not a political issue. This is humanitarian. This is life. This is a human life. It has nothing to do with a Republican or a Democrat or a left or a right or conservative or liberal. This is life.
Hi, Lauren.
Of course, we're here, Brian, though, to sit down and talk with Cory Booker. He's here at this rally.
He's actually still emceeing the event on the steps in front of the Capitol here.
And apparently can't stop talking. That was just an editorial observation.
So it's delayed our interview slightly.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing from Senator Booker about all kinds of things, what's happening here in Washington and the country, his views on this healthcare legislation, and of
Russia,
course,
President Trump.
Yeah, and his presidential aspirations. Many people have seen him as a rising star, so we'll hear what he has to say about that.
Although, Katie, you can't swing your purse where we are right now without hitting a potential Democratic presidential candidate. I think I've seen a half dozen of them in the last 20 minutes.
That's true. Here is Senator Cory Booker. Welcome to our podcast, and what a day here in Washington, D.C.
Can I just say for a second, you and I have been friends for a long time. I feel at a disadvantage when I'm being interviewed by you because I feel so comfortable with you. I might just be telling all.
Well, if you want to break some news and announce your candidacy for 2020, feel free.
I will announce. I am running in 2020 for re-election.
Does New Jersey law permit you to run for both?
I don't even know. So,
good question, Brian.
That is an interesting question.
I'm sure you're going to figure out the answer to that question pretty soon.
You two are very mischievous.
Uh-huh. We are, and Brian is very prepared.
Is he
so
really?
Warning, Senator. But before
he was pulling stuff out of my bio in the elevator.
I know.
How did he know my favorite breakfast cereal is Captain Crunch with Crunch Berries? How did
and
you know that?
And that you drink Diet Mountain Dew, even though your girlfriend tells you not to. Well, before we talk more about you and your background.
It is a day, eventful day.
Yeah, let's talk about, from your perspective, how do you process what just transpired?
It is so unconscionable I think for those of you who don't know, John McCain gave a very dramatic speech in the Senate after he voted to proceed to a bill when he didn't even know what was in the bill. I mean, this whole process from this very beginning is a betrayal of every Senate tradition, every Senate custom. It's even a betrayal for all those people who think Obamacare was just shoved through. Obamacare had hundreds of bipartisan meetings, committee hearings, hundreds of witnesses. It actually was amended multiple times by the Republicans. Republican
amendments. But it did pass with nary a Republican vote.
Absolutely. But there was a process that was akin to what the Senate's supposed to do, where lots of people were invited in. As John McCain himself said, this was a process that was done in secrecy, behind closed doors, just a handful of Republicans, no hearings, no witnesses, no input. It was roundly condemned by nonpartisan, not bipartisan, but nonpartisan groups.
Like the AMA?
The American Medical Association, American Hospital Association, American Cancer Society. I mean, everybody who we think of as beyond politics in the medical and healthcare industry world condemned this bill, the AARP. And so then suddenly, literally, people are being interviewed in the days before this, Republicans and saying, I don't know what's in this bill. And they just voted to proceed to a bill that they don't even know what's in it. And that's what's unconscionable to me, that this is what has just transpired in the United States Senate.
But what didn't they basically say, and didn't John McCain say in his speech, Senator, that we need to discuss this, we need to consider it. And as a result, isn't it possible that the ultimate final bill could look very different than the one that they've
just
presented?
Proceeded to, yes. Well, he actually went even further, which again,
He wouldn't vote for it.
He wouldn't vote for it.
In its current incarnation.
In its current incarnation, unless it changed quite a bit. But he, like others, I'm glad I've expressed skepticism about voting for a bill that gave massive tax breaks to the wealthiest amongst us, savage Medicare to the tune of 10 to 15 million Americans, drove up costs for older Americans, undermined access to Medicaid for people in extended care. There's a lot of parts of this bill that were hard to stomach for House members who were hoping Republicans over here would change it. But I haven't seen a change in which Mitch McConnell could hold together the disparate members of his coalition, from the Rand Pauls and Mike Lees
Susan Collins.
To the Susan Collins and Senator Murkowski from Alaska.
But of course, he held the coalition together today.
I don't
they
know what
passed the motion to proceed. And
yes.
So a lot of Democrats believe that these complaints, these criticisms among Republicans ring hollow because ultimately their votes are different than their statements.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to the president. I mean, the president, if you just take him on what he said, I won't cut Medicaid, I won't cut Medicare, I'm going to provide health care that gives greater access, that is more affordable, and I think the exact word he used was terrific. Health care was going to be terrific. Well, this bill, on an unqualified manner, CBO, as well as many other outside experts have said, this will make health care more expensive for the average American. It will restrict access for tens of millions of Americans, and it will drive down the quality of the care that many Americans have access to. So this is nothing like what people have been saying. Where we should be, and even what John McCain said today, is we should all take a breather. What did the Affordable Care Act do that we like? Most Americans love the pre-existing conditions preserving. Most Americans like the Medicaid expansion. Obviously, some governors didn't do it. Most Americans like a lot of aspects, parity between mental health care and so-called physical health care. There's a lot in this bill that people liked. And so let's hold the line on those things and try to improve the things that are somewhat problematic. It's problematic, for example, that in the healthcare exchanges, a small percentage of people weren't getting subsidies and more.
Well, are you hopeful then that there will be some kind of compromise going on as things move forward? Or do you think that now Republicans have been emboldened by this motion to proceed or whatever you call it?
So the Senate doesn't give me hope. What gives me hope is what the American people have been doing. Incredible outpourings of protests from people on both sides of the political aisle, cramming into people's town hall meetings, demanding that they walk away from a bill that would hurt them and their families. This is the week, I would say, that people who have to speak up again and let folks know there'll be consequences if they vote on such a disastrous bill that will hurt American families of all backgrounds, all geographies, all races, all parties.
Now, Democrats have spoken in very general terms about fixing Obamacare. Your position is sort of mend it, don't end it. But what specific improvements or changes do you think should be made?
Well, look, I'm one of those Americans that believes that we need to have a different philosophy of healthcare needs to be made real in legislation, which is that healthcare is a right, that we need to have a nation in which everyone is covered, in which everyone has affordable and quality healthcare. That should be the end that we should express. Now, I believe there's lots of avenues to get there.
Should there be a single payer system?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Medicare for all. We were one vote shy. I wasn't in the Senate then, when the Affordable Care Act passed, of extending Medicare down to people age 50. I believe that would have been the small end of the wedge. I believe at the end, other end of that would have been people saying, wow, it's working. Medicare is working for now for people all the way down to 50. Let's expand it for everybody. So I think the Medicare for all idea is a really good idea. Public options are a really good idea. But I'm a big believer that the way we're trying to go about this is actually giving lots of profits to private interests that are taking money out of the healthcare system and adding great expense to it. But in the meantime, I'm also a realist, as John McCain said today, that, you know, given where we are right now with Democrats in the minority and Republicans in the majority, Republicans controlling two houses of Congress and the White House, that we're going to have to try to do what you said, mend Obamacare, don't end it, make it better, and do some incremental changes unless we see Congress change in the 2018
election. But that doesn't seem very desirable politically, does it? I mean, the the president and many of these people ran on the platform of getting rid of Obamacare, repealing Obamacare. And I think they're not going to want the appearance of mending, not ending, because it will still be Obamacare.
So this is the thing that makes is almost laughable
right? Am I
to
right,
me.
Though?
Well, no, I don't think you're right, because here's a president we have found can lie to the American public. It can have Fox News repeating everything that they're saying. You don't think he could have said, I'm bringing in Trump Care and we're going to do this and this and this, but the real bill would have just amended it. He could have called it anything he wanted. Here's one of the best carnival barkers I've ever seen in American politics, who could tell people that he was transforming healthcare, and really what he did was keep everything that people liked and made things better. He could have done it that way, in a bipartisan way. Here's a president that has missed opportunity after opportunity to be who he said he was going to be, the great deal maker. This is a guy who had a wide opportunity to be a unifying force in this country, to bring people together, to deal with our major issues, but he has completely botched it. And instead, he's appealing to a very narrow base with outrageous demonization and demagoguery, the kind of things that are hurting America.
And well, given his campaign, are you really surprised?
I'm disappointed. His campaign was outraged me. I mean, I was so confident he was going to lose because I did not believe anybody can ascend to the White House in this day and age by demeaning and degrading other Americans, whether it's Mexicans, Muslims, people in inner cities, even the way he talked about African Americans, all of these things, not to mention women. I didn't think that was possible. But hey, I was wrong. And I think a lot of Democrats were wrong because they didn't understand the level of pain that people were going through, and then how Donald Trump was finding a way to talk to that pain in ways that Democratic leaders were not. And so here we are in this condition right now.
I just am curious, in terms of this health care legislation, is this going to come back to bite Republicans in the butt in 2018 if they, in fact, support a bill that leaves many people uninsured?
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
I mean, are you guys going to really make hay with this?
Listen, if you hurt my neighborhood, my community, I live in Newark, New Jersey. I live in the Central Ward. The median income in my neighborhood is $14,000 per household. And when I walk around my community, people are really worried and really afraid. And this bill that they just proceeded to, which we don't really know what's in, but if we listen to the CBO and their past versions, this bill will devastate communities like mine, rural communities, cities across this country, people with disabilities. I mean, it's a devastating bill. So will I politically say, if you guys do this, you should suffer the consequences at the polls? Heck yeah, I hope that happens. But I got hours now, and I'm going to do everything I can to fight to prevent that from happening, because I'm not looking for political advantage. I'm looking for helping people, and we should stop this bill from happening.
What do you make of the argument that just as the Republicans have moved too far to the right, Democrats have gone off the left side of the cliff? Because
how so? I mean, what in
well,
what ways?
I think on trade, you could make the argument that they've abandoned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, buying a bunch of arguments that aren't really legitimate about what it would have done to American workers, when really it's automation far more than trade that have cost jobs. On single payer, my home state of California, which has Democratic supermajorities,
right,
tried to pass single payer, and it didn't work because the cost of it was more than the whole state budget, and there was no answer for how it could be affordable.
Right.
And some of the rhetoric, this is not my opinion, but the opinion of many independent analysts, is us versus them, but the them isn't a Muslim or a Mexican, it's a billionaire or a banker. Or somebody in one of the industries like prescription drugs or healthcare that Democrats have decided are not good for America.
So I'm a former mayor, and I think the Wall Street Journal said I was the 21st person in American history to go straight from being a mayor to being a United States senator. I had to fix stuff. I couldn't use philosophy. As Theodore LaGuardia said, there's no Republican or Democratic way to fix a pothole. You just got to fix it. And that's the way I view the country right now. And I've seen Trump trash trade deals as much as you see people on either side of the aisle doing it. I don't think my party, in a very pragmatic way, is going off the rails in some way. I don't want to use the spectrums of left and right, because I'm not even sure what is left, what is right anymore. I think that, the core of my party is saying are pragmatic things that in a balance sheet analysis, which is what I had to use every day as a mayor, that net-net, they create wealth, they create growth, they create opportunity. And I'll just give some things that people might want to characterize as left. Like, let's take something like funding housing. Well, Seattle did a study, a great organization called Plymouth Housing Group out there, said, what is more expensive, supportive housing for people with special needs and mental health issues or keeping them on the streets? They actually found out they saved $1 million to taxpayers by taking people off the streets and putting them in supportive housing. Why? Well, people who ran cities know this. They end up in our emergency rooms, end up in our jails. It's more expensive to do the morally unsound thing. Let's use another example. Why is it that all of our competitors have paid family leave and universal preschool? Because they know when you invest in children, it is in a global knowledge-based environment, it is the most valuable natural resource a country has. It's no longer coal or gas or oil. It's the genius of your children, and you've got to put it in an environment to cultivate that. So I can show you all the things that are the core base of the Democratic Party that appeal to people from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren all the way to Mark Warner and Joe Manchin. Things that we believe in, like raising the minimum wage. We now have data that looks at places like Seattle and other places that shows that you don't crush small businesses when you do
that.
But
I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that it really did cause a lot of people to lose their jobs in Seattle, according to a study, that a lot of businesses had to fire people when they raised the minimum wage.
Right, so I saw
Was that on Fox News or something?
Exactly. No, there's been some data that's come out that's been highly disputed about the impact of minimum wage. But let's pull back even from Seattle. There's so much study about places that raise the minimum wage, including New Jersey, that raises the minimum wage did not affect business growth. And in fact, the best evidence for that is that when the minimum wage was established in the 1960s, in real dollars, it's much higher than it is now. If you just had kept up with inflation, it would be over $15 an hour. So if it was undermining growth back then, it wasn't. In fact, those years, 60s, 70s, were some of the greatest expansions of the middle class we've ever seen. I just believe that forget Democrat or Republican, investing in children, investing in seniors, investing in the poor. We've got to be a nation like our past, like in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, that invested in Americans and invested in America, education, infrastructure, science and research and development, all those things that this generation of Republicans have turned our government away from, and other nations, including immigration, by the way. Other nations, Canada, Germany, Japan, what are they saying? Oh, my God, look what America is turning away from its past. Well, we're going to out-America you. We're going to invest in our infrastructure more than you are, except for building prisons. We're going to invest in education more than you are. We're going to invest in immigration. What do they have out in Silicon Valley? They say, hey, can't get your H-1B visa? Come to Canada. We want you. Because college presidents come to me and say, we're graduating people in degrees I can't even spell, microimmunology, biology, whatever it is. And as soon as they finish their student visa, the brightest minds on the planet Earth, we kick them out of our country. So we've got to get back to doing what actually worked in America to build out the middle class, to close the race gap, to give more people avenues out, social mobility, out of poverty, into the middle class, that other countries are now doing better than us. We need to get back to being better at being America than other people are.
Why do you think Hillary Clinton was unsuccessful prosecuting the argument that you just made?
And why do you think that it seems, I think there was another survey I read recently, I read so much, sometimes you can't even remember what you read and where, that said people still don't know what Democrats stand for. Wasn't there a
poll. That's
poll
not
recently.
Fake news. Yeah.
Yes.
And so they're trying to fill in that gap with the agenda you announced this week.
But, yes.
But why have Democrats failed to make this case that you're
and Hillary
clearly
Clinton
so impassioned
in particular.
About?
Well, look, I think that we need to get back to understanding as a country, all of us, that we have a common pain and we need to get back to a common national purpose. And for some reason, we don't feel like we have a common pain anymore. I've visited from the rural areas that are predominantly white and poor in my state to the minority areas, inner city areas are predominantly black, Latino, and poor. And the struggles that people are having are so much the same, whether it's trying to incarcerate yourself out of a drug problem and you're seeing people getting arrested at outrageous rates, not getting drug treatment, to not having schools that are providing the kind of pathways to middle-class jobs that we need, we have a common pain, but we haven't talked about a common purpose.
Yeah, but there's a lot of evidence that Donald Trump won not because of economic pain, but because of cultural identification and polarization. Many of his voters were not economically struggling or were economically better off than they were when they voted 4 years ago for Barack Obama. So if it's just about Democrats providing a stronger economic message,
I talked to Neera Tanden, who's an extraordinary leader of the Center for American Progress today.
And a very close aide to Hillary Clinton.
Yes. And she was saying to me that she was looking at a map of Clinton voters versus Trump voters. And he saw that you had these interesting realities where you saw a lot of these urban areas where are starting to grow again. I mean, Newark, New Jersey, where I was mayor, first time, greatest economic development period since the 1960s. You see population growth. First time since the 1960s that our population is growing. You're seeing a lot of these urban areas that are starting to see economic growth and opportunity. You're seeing a lot of folks supporting Secretary Clinton, where she won. You're seeing a lot of these other areas that are not, that are losing factories. And I agree with you, more because of the microchip than Mexicans, but are starting to see losses, coal mining towns, a lot of people that are suffering economically, and nobody is showing them that this is an inclusive vision for America, that Donald Trump was able to come in there and exploit that pain and actually say, it's not your fault, it's the Mexicans' fault. It's not your fault, it's the Muslims' fault. It's not your fault, it's these crazy left-wing people who are serving the elites, and really sold them this idea that we don't have a better economic plan. Where I know fundamentally, if you are struggling in a rural town, which party is fighting for the earned income tax credit? Which party is fighting for the raising your minimum wage? Which party wants to fight against more tax breaks for the wealthiest of people and more opportunity for you in your schools and your community colleges so you can afford education or training? That's the Democratic Party. But Donald Trump was such a good carnival barker that he strolled on in to places where that people voted for Obama twice and really sell to them this us versus them. Anytime a leader tries to divide this country against itself, we should reject that leader. Anytime a leader tries to say we're all in this together, we need each other, we have one common destiny, that's the leader I want to follow. Unfortunately, Donald Trump played the divide and conquer, and he was able to win the presidency. And he's still trying to govern that way, dividing and conquering, but he's dividing the Senate, he's dividing the House, and what's happening is America's getting the raw deal.
Do you think Bernie Sanders ever plays divide and conquer politics?
Look, I think that Senator Sanders provided a vision for this country on policy that was bold and visionary to say, hey, we need to be a nation that educates again, and pointing out the realities of how expensive it is to go to college, something that's really, I think, very attractive to me. And so he painted in broad strokes, bold strokes that captured the imagination of a lot of Americans. And so did he vilify this us versus them, wealthy elites and what have you? I'm a person that said that my style of politics is I'm not going to demonize anybody. I'm not saying that Bernie Sanders did, but I am going to point things out, like the ridiculousness of carried interest, for crying out loud. I mean, you got to be kidding me. Anybody who's benefiting from that massive tax loophole, while there are people in inner cities that are struggling with environmental desolation because we can't fund Superfund cleanup sites. I mean, dear God, give up your carried interest so that we can clean up the most toxic environments that are poisoning our children. That's inexcusable to me for people to be able to benefit in ways through the tax code that are hurting other people. Now, I'm not demonizing those people, but I'm calling out things that our nation is doing that's hurting people.
It's time to take a quick break. When we return, more with Senator Cory Booker right after this.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
And now back with Senator Cory Booker.
I think for a lot of people, you're probably more famous than well-known. Okay. And so we want to give people a better sense of who you actually are, where you come from.
He grew up in a small town in New Jersey.
How does that
His
movie
parents were two of the first black executives at IBM.
Well, how does the movie The Jerk start? I was born a poor black child with no rhythm.
And that was Steve Martin,
Martin, The Jerk, yes. Yeah. I'm glad you know that. I make these jokes now in front of millennial audiences, and they give me blank faces.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually an 80-year-old man.
Are you really?
In a
35-year-old body.
It's all
body.
The Botox. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. 35-year-old body. That's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
But talk a little bit about your childhood, Cory, for Senator Booker, for people who are listening, because you've had such a fascinating life. And paint what life was like in a mostly white New Jersey suburb called Harrington Park.
Well, I think the great drama of my life happened when I was only a full month old, which is to be born to two black parents who really struggled and are products of a revolution in this country. They're products of a civil rights revolution and rode that wave of the struggles of so many people who opened up doors, including them, that opened up doors for them that were unheard of in the black community. My father, born poor to a single mother, he used to say, son, I couldn't afford to be poor. I was just P-O. I couldn't afford the other two letters. This is my dad's childhood seemed to get worse the older he got. But the truth is But my dad did grow up in a segregated town in the mountains of North Carolina to a mother who couldn't ultimately take care of him and was taken in by a family in the community, raised in the black church, who put money together in a collection plate to try to get him off to a historically black college where he landed in the midst of the civil rights movement. The sit-in movement started right there in North Carolina. And next thing you know, he's watching the country change, rushing with his friends to join up with people of all backgrounds to fight to tear down these walls of segregation. At that time, after college, he lands in Washington, D.C., where we're sitting. And again, right place, right time, right education. It was activists in the Urban League and other places that started putting pressure on companies or working with companies to hire their first ever blacks in certain jobs. So my dad becomes the first black person hired by IBM in the Virginia area as a salesman. And then you put qualified people. I don't care if they're gay, if they're people with disabilities, you give qualified people an opportunity, they thrive. And next thing you know, my dad is just their top 5% of global salesmen, gets a promotion up to Manhattan. And he will tell you at that point in his life, in his late 20s, he was living a life beyond his dreams of a small kid in a poor town. And so
Your mom worked for IBM
My
as
mom,
well.
The same story. I mean, really so similar. She actually had two parents that my grandfather was a UAW, one of their first early black union workers, and was able to provide my mom with even a little bit more stability than my dad had. And my grandmother and grandfather raised my mom and sent her off to Fisk University, a great HBCU in Memphis, Tennessee. And she herself moved to D.C., started working in their public schools as a speech pathologist, and then also became one of IBM's early black executives. And so here you have these two folks products of the civil rights movement, products of historically black colleges, all these interventions that tried to create a more equal society. And then they try to move into Harrington Park, New Jersey, this incredible town which I would grow up in, but they were denied houses in this area of Bergen County. So again, activism had to try to step in. And again, you know, with the sting operation, these incredible lawyers in the Fair Housing Council and activists, they let my parents go look at a house, and then they would send a white couple to look at my house, the house afterwards. My parents loved this house. They were told it was sold. The white couple found the house, found it was for sale, put a bid on the house for my parents. The bid was accepted, papers drawn up, and on the day of the closing, they surprised the real estate agent. And
surprise!
And they, but amazingly, when they, the real estate agent,
incredible.
Yeah, but the real estate agent didn't capitulate. He didn't just say, "You got me." He actually got up and punched my dad's lawyer in the face and signed a dog on my dad. And after this big melee in this office, lawyers got involved, the whole thing, and eventually they relented and we bought this house and we moved in. And so my father used to tease us and call us the four raisins in a tub of sweet vanilla ice cream. And so imagine just this. By the time I'm 18 years old, they spent 18 years lecturing my brother and I, do not forget where you came from. Do not forget the struggle that got you here. You drink deeply from wells of freedom, liberty, and opportunity that you didn't dig. My dad's smart remark to me would always be, boy, don't you dare walk around this house like you hit a triple. You were born on third base. And you can't pay back all those people that fought for you, struggled for you, but you're damn well going to pay it forward by finding a way of being a service. And my dad was impatient. You know, who would have thought his son, I went to Stanford University, and I always have to confess, I got in because of a 4.0 and 1,600, 4.0 yards per carry, 1,600 receiving yards.
Something tells me you've used that
I've used it all the time to let people know that I got in.
Because
I was a damn good football player, or at least a above average high school football player.
You were smart, too. You were a Rhodes Scholar. You went on to Yale Law School.
Yeah, but my dad, as I'm doing all that stuff, he's like, boy, you got more degrees in the month of July, but you ain't hot. When are you gonna do something for this country? You were given all this privilege and all this opportunity to join the fight because you won't be called to ride buses on freedom rides, to march to Selma, to register people to vote. And folks were dying, Goodman, Cheney, Schwerner in the 60s. But all those people put that effort out for you. What are you going to do to prove worthy? So my brother and I, who were programmed from an early age to feel this sort of outrageous gratitude to this country, but also this understanding as my father, who raised us in the black church, who always kept us close to the black community, you know, family in Newark, you name it, wanted to point out to my brother and I that there are people struggling outrageous injustices not of their own making, and you need to be just as committed to dealing with those injustices as your ancestors, your parents and grandparents and their generation were committed to fighting injustices that existed then.
So you mentioned Newark. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that in your last year at Yale Law School, you commuted 2 hours to and from Newark in order to go to classes, which is a pretty rare thing to do. You didn't grow up in Newark. Your parents didn't live in Newark. What connected you to Newark, and why did you decide to make your life there?
Well, gosh, by the time I was in law school, I had, from the time I was 18 to graduating law school at 27, that like decade was all about cities for me. And everywhere I would go, I just wanted to be a part of cities and not only the urban struggle, but also the urban imagination and trying to create better things. And so I had some family in the way you call your parents, close friends, aunts and uncles, who lived in Newark, who knew Newark, and I had grown up sort of coming back and forth there. And I just felt connected to this community and decided that that's where I was going to move. And my dream was to be Jeffrey Canada. He was my hero coming out of law school, who was the head of something called the Harlem Children's Zone. And if you read his book, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, you see that he looked for the toughest neighborhood he could find and moved into that neighborhood. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to do the same thing.
You lived in public housing.
I moved into on Martin Luther King Boulevard, the southern part of that street in Newark, was greeted with my stuff being stolen out of my car when I was moving into this small place. But I met heroes. Some of the most moving and I was saying I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD on the streets of Newark.
I read that. I mean, if you had to think of one person who really taught you something, I was intrigued by that statement. who was the best teacher you had?
Well, I had incredible professors.
I don't mean professors. I mean the people in the public housing.
They were street professors. These were professors of the neighborhood. So Miss Virginia Jones, who was a tenant president of the buildings that I would move into, these tough projects, whose son was murdered in the lobby of the building in which I lived in the 80s. She caught me right when I landed in Newark from Yale, put me in my place real quick. She says, like, you're going to help me. She goes, describe this neighborhood. I still remember this moment where she says, I'm like, what? She goes, describe the neighborhood. And I described it like it was at a crack house that I lived right next to. It had these the projects. I described it sort of a tough view of the neighborhood, like anybody would probably see with their own eyes. And she just said, you know, you can never help me then. And I go, why? She goes, because the world you see outside of you is always a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of these people who only sees problems and darkness and despair, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of these stubborn people who every time you open your eyes, you see hope, you see opportunity, you see love, you see the face of God, then you can be someone that helps me. And I began just by sitting in her apartment and watching people line up at the door at different times to come in for help, whether their son needed a job or they were having difficulty meeting the rent, or the worst slumlord I had ever sort of experienced, which we eventually took on and eventually got convicted in federal court. But she was this amazing person who lived her life to serve others. And she was fierce. I mean, she was tough. I mean, she was a 5 feet and a smidgen tall, but intimidated me at 6'3". Do you stay in touch with her? She's passed away now.
Are you kidding me?
I couldn't go a day or multiple days without her calling me up to bark orders at me, even when I was mayor of the city. And look, she taught me the definition of hope, which was that hope is not – it doesn't exist in an abstract. Hope is confronting the wretchedness of the world, seeing the depravity. Hope doesn't exist in abstract. You can't have great hope unless there's great despair. Hope is this active conviction that despair will not have the last word. So yeah, here's this woman. They murder her son in the lobby of the building. She and I were probably the two of the highest net worth owners in those buildings. We could have lived anywhere, but she never, ever left. Like Mamie Till, who kept Emmett Till's coffin open, she decided that she was going to be an agent of hope, an instrument of hope in a world that desperately needs it. And so it was women like her that taught me, and I broke a few times in my time in Newark. And I still remember after witnessing a horrible time where a young boy died, and I just wanted to give up. I was so angry at the world. And this woman, I'll never forget. It was just her and I in the courtyard of these projects, and I'm this big guy, but she just held me like a little child, and I just broke inside. I soaked her shirt, just weeping on this woman's shoulder. I was so angry. I get emotional thinking about it right now. And all she did was hold me and say over and over again, stay faithful, stay faithful, stay faithful. And so that to me is this message right now. And most Americans – And this has been interesting, and I lost my temper a little bit in a speech I was giving yesterday to a bunch of lawyers about everybody wants to focus on Donald Trump. There's outrageous injustices going on in this world before Donald Trump. You know, people said, oh, Corey, there was 10% drops in African-American votes in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. And I'm like, it's not just people in rural white communities, it's people in urban black communities who are beginning to lose faith that this government's going to do anything because we're not seeing each other or suffering. I went through Louisiana and Alabama a few weekends ago just to visit places in rural America, Tallahassee, Alabama, Uniontown, Alabama, and just to bear witness, people packed these churches because they couldn't believe they were so grateful that a federal official was coming down and looking at the hell in which they're living because we allowed the worst type of hateful hypocrisy and corporate villainy where these companies locate environmental disasters, whether it's landfills or imagine a place that everybody knows it is Cancer Alley where these petrochemical companies are releasing hundreds of times higher rates of carcinogens into the air than other communities. And people are just saying, why won't anybody do something?
And why do we accept it? Is it racism?
So look, I think racism is something we need to confront and tell the truth about. Why is it when you ask, Harvard did a study, I think, it was them that asked Americans to picture a drug dealer. Black and white Americans, 95% say somebody black. Ask the majority of Americans to picture a welfare recipient, and the majority of them will describe somebody that's black.
Even the majority, though the majority are white.
Majority of both of those circumstances or plurality are white people. And so I do think race is this pernicious evil that we don't speak enough because it often puts people in defensive posture as opposed to speaking to it in a way that calls to our compassion or our empathy for the truth. And so what your question is, does race complicate and compound this problem? Hell yeah. When you have a criminal justice system, rightfully, as Michelle Alexander calls, the new Jim Crow, it is devastating, aggravating racial problems in this country in terms of disparities in outcome, because there's no difference between blacks and whites for using drugs or even dealing drugs. In fact, some studies show that young white men have a little bit higher rates. But you and I both know, all three of us who went to college campuses, nobody at Stanford was getting stopped and frisked for using drugs. There was no FBI stings on the local fraternity. And you and I, all of us know, and I don't mean to put you guys and implicate you guys in this, but you know where to get the pot from, the Adderall, the ecstasy.
Brian definitely does.
You know where to get ecstasy, my God.
Okay.
What do you take me for?
But rich and privileged people, we live in a country, as Brian Stevenson says, where you get a better sense of justice if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent.
I love Brian Stevenson, parenthetically.
He's like the Mandela of America.
Why doesn't he run for president?
Because he's doing more important work and making more of a difference than he could.
You don't really believe that. He's making more of a difference than if he were president of the United States.
Well, I think the reality is, I heard it more as like, why doesn't he run for the Senate?
And
he's getting more done than a senator.
But
if I can blink my eyes and replace the current president with Brian Stevenson, I think that we would be...
You'd be pleased.
I'd
but
be
before
pleased.
We completely lose the thread of your biography...
I'm sorry.
We're limited on time. So, one thing you are very famous for, all these good works, the 10-day hunger strike to draw attention to drug dealing. You spent a week subsisting on the budget of a food stamp recipient. You have lived in one of the most crime-plagued areas, not just in your state, but the country. And I think for most people, this is all extraordinarily laudable. But the knock on you among some snarky liberals is that these are stunts. As I was researching this podcast, Salon wrote, he's done a lot of stunts designed to make people aware of poverty, or at least to make people aware of Cory Booker's awareness of poverty. And I'm just curious, what's your reaction when you see something like that?
I don't. I mean, look— if people are not criticizing you, you probably aren't doing that much to make change, to make a difference. And, I love my neighborhood. And if people want to say, in fact, I know lots of leaders have decided to go live in the projects for a week or something like that. I've lived in my community for 8 years in Brick Towers, and I still live in that same neighborhood right now. I love my neighbors. It's my community. I'm not doing it to bring attention. I'm doing it because I love my community. And frankly, I'm living my values. I think that we have divided ourselves too much. We put walls up against. So I just love where I live, and I love and I am who I am.
It's hard to have an 8-year stunt, isn't it?
Yes, or now a 20 years. In fact, when I became mayor, I decided to move into the only time I've moved out of the neighborhood I've lived in. I lived in there 8 years before mayor, and I've lived there since I've become a senator. This is my community. But I decided to move into the section of the city as mayor where there were the most shootings. Now, what if all of our leaders had to do that? Because what I call about hateful hypocrisy is when you are comfortable because your family and you live in a nice neighborhood. You're sworn to uphold this constitution, to liberty and justice for all, but your family's not on the line.
Brian Stevenson talks about the importance of being proximate.
Yes.
Yes. That we're all so siloed.
The Pope, when he warned his priests, go out and be amongst the people, smell like the people. I just think there's something powerful about leadership that doesn't separate itself, doesn't put itself above, puts itself with. And I swore to myself, in fact, Miss Jones made me, literally made me. She said, this is when I was elected to city council. She warned me that often we elect people to council and they leave us. And I made a commitment to this amazing woman that I will not leave. So where do I live? I live still in that community.
I've decided your campaign song better be me,
and
me,
Mrs. Jones. I hope people giggle that song.
We got a thing going. going on.
But what, how do you think that, like, if all...
I sing it every podcast, so thank you for allowing me to do that.
So you worked it in very nicely, actually.
But I just want to ask the question. What would we be doing right now if, about Superfund sites, if every senator, like me, lived within a mile of a Superfund site?
Or about healthcare if every senator didn't have healthcare.
What would we do about violent crime if every senator had to live in the part of their state with the most violent crime? I don't know if any other senator had a shooting on their block this last month or two. What would we be doing about violent crime? What would we be doing about drug addiction if every senator lived across the street? I live across the street from one of Integrity House facility. I've gone and sat with the men and women who sit in a circle of recovery. I just think that I don't care what people say about it. My entire adult life, I've lived and worked in inner city communities. And over my desk in my office is the map of the central ward of Newark where I live. That's where my career, professional life coming out of law school started. And every decision I make, whether it's battling for healthcare, for prescription drugs, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, whether it's dealing with the criminal justice system, whether it's infrastructure, I actually want to use the lens of the community in which I live in to guide my decisions. Because I love it when I go home, you know, folk don't take me seriously. They don't take my title seriously. They take me seriously. But they don't care. They don't care about the politics often, the debates and the positioning. What they really care about is, hey, this is what's going on our street. And when I was mayor, it gave me great satisfaction. I got to see to stand there with people and say, look, we got that park built. We have that new supermarket in town. We're building some new affordable housing here. And as a senator who has to come down to Washington every week, I don't want to be pulled too far away from the urgencies that got me in politics and the responsibility I have to the people.
There was an Oscar-nominated fabulous documentary about your first campain.
Yeah, which is called I always advise fight. If you're going to have a spectacular failure in your life, have a documentary team there to capture it.
you capture and Anthony Weiner.
Yeah, I think he comes across a little better than Anthony Weiner in his documentary. I will say that.
But you
want to
know
low bar.
You want to know the ignominy, and that's not it. The real shame of the documentary is that so my most humiliating loss gets captured in this documentary film, gets nominated for an Oscar, and guess what it loses to in the Academy Awards?
I don't know.
March of the Dagnab Penguins.
Ooh, it's like that's
it's hard to compete with a penguin.
And Morgan Freeman, for crying out loud, driving Miss Daisy. Like, he's got the best voice in the world. If he had narrated our film, we probably would have.
No, it's the old Hollywood rule. You never compete with the animals.
Oh, you're the animals.
Because
okay.
The audience always likes the animals.
I thought
better.
The rule is you never compete with Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, well, that's true as well. But so
God, right?
Yeah, he is God.
You won,
and the president.
You won 4 years after the campaign that was captured in that film. And probably the thing that got the most national attention was Mark Zuckerberg coming in.
Tell me that was not the most national attention. I can give you more things that captured it, but that was a big moment.
That was a big moment.
Yes.
And he offered to spend $100 million, did in fact spend $100 million to try to turn around Newark schools, which you said would be a model of educational excellence.
Yes.
And other philanthropists came in with even more money.
Yes.
How do you assess the results of that experiment?
An outrageous success. If you just look at the data of the Newark school system, and by the way, he wasn't the only factor contributing to the successes the school system has had. But let's pull back and look at what does the data say about the Newark school system right now. Well, we just recently, it's been about over a year, were ranked the number one city in America for beat-the-odds schools, high poverty, high performance. So you have schools that have taken kids from extraordinarily difficult circumstances, graduating them. Number two is, if you're an African-American kid in Newark, which is the majority of our kids, and they tended to be in the worst performing schools, your chances of going to a high performing school from the time I was mayor to about now went up 300%. The overall performance in the Newark school system on reading, math went up double digit percentages. Our graduation rate went up double digit percentages. So, you know, in terms of a school system, in a very short period of time, giving parents incredibly high quality options. In fact, as the studies have shown, better options than most inner city public schools have. It's been ridiculously successful. We still have work to do, but the supercharged success of our schools, especially that one indice, about 300% more likely now if you're Black in Newark to go to a high-performing school, is pretty dramatic.
But Newark charter schools outperform district schools. And I'm just curious why there's so much controversy about charter schools within the Democratic Party, largely because of teachers' unions.
Well, I wouldn't say largely because of only teachers' unions.
But that's a big factor, wouldn't
you agree?
Absolutely,
a big factor. But let's let's try to separate the critics from the criticism. So I will join people in criticizing charter schools if they are endangering public schools, if they are creaming the best students, if they are not held to the same standards of performance as traditional district schools. So I always say, let's filter out the critics and just look at really what we want. Like if a charter school moved into a rural area, you got to be kidding me. Like Heidi Heitkamp and Tester, we talk about this all the time. It just wouldn't work and it would endanger the system that's there. So there are legitimate criticisms in general of charter schools. And that's why in Newark, we try to do things a different way, creating a one enrollment plan so you're not creaming people, trying to appropriately finance our school system, which is always a battle, especially with a Republican governor, so that you're not in any way creating a lack of equity in funding. A lot of things I think that you can do in an environment like Newark where charter schools can work, but charter schools aren't for everywhere, and you have to make sure that they're being held to the same standards.
Now, you emphasize public schools, but why shouldn't poor kids have the same opportunity as rich kids to go to a private school if that's the right choice for them?
Again, I'm one of those few Democrats that says, I think that we should have a system that doesn't just work for the rich and the wealthy. That's why I've supported things like the White Fellowship in Newark, which takes—
Are you for vouchers?
Under the most narrow of circumstances, if your chill child is stopped in a routinely failing school and is poor and does not have the ability, I think the public should be saying to that, this is a crisis of monumental proportion, and the public should do whatever it can to get that child out of that environment. And I believe in what you call whatever you want, but a rescue package for those children. Do I support charter schools and innovation in the right context, in the right environment? As we've seen in Newark, I will fight for them. Do I support rescuing kids that are in dropout factories and things like that with interventions? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, we can never as a country abandon this idea of great public schools for every child.
So there are a lot of issues we want to hit, and we have very limited time in which to do it. But you mentioned mass incarceration earlier. I know you're very passionate about this issue. It's a major problem in this country. And this was supposed to be the one thing that could get done last year on a bipartisan basis. It failed in part.
I interviewed Senator Booker and Rand Paul about this together. Talk about an odd couple.
In the Senate. Yeah, no, it's one of my earliest interviews in the Senate.
And it failed in part because of then-Senator Jeff Sessions leading the opposition to it. Why didn't that legislation come together, and what are its prospects now?
So first of all, it as a guy who's now closing in October with my full 4 years in the Senate, there's no better journey that I've seen so far than me coming into the Senate and hearing Chuck Grassley going to the floor and speaking against the innovations and reforms that I wanted, to over time becoming a partner of mine and other Democrats in a very ambitious and progressive bill that actually got out of the Judiciary Committee with bipartisan votes. And almost as if it got votes on the floor, it would have gotten 80 plus votes. And so, yeah, as older senators or senators who've been here longer put their arm around me and say, look, sometimes it takes two or three Congresses to get something done. Don't give up on this. And not only haven't I given up, but we're pushing more legislation focused on women in prison, because folks don't know that about 86% of the women in prison are survivors of sexual trauma, sexual abuse, and we put them in more trauma when we put them in prison. We focused on marijuana, which you gratefully interviewed Rand Paul and I on, but that coalition has expanded now. More Republicans, more Democrats jumping on to reform marijuana laws. Again, most Americans, the reason why injustices often fester is because most Americans don't realize it. So we have people that have lost their voting rights for a lifetime. One out of five African Americans in Florida cannot vote because of felony disenfranchisement. And many of them were for doing things two of the last three presidents admitted to doing. Remember, Bush and Obama, it wasn't smoking a little bit of marijuana. It was felony drug possession of drugs more serious than marijuana. So here we have this hypocrisy in our country, where if you're a privileged kid going to a fancy college, go ahead and experiment all you want. I've sat in this body in Congress listening to colleagues joking about the laws that they broke, but they were privileged people. They didn't have to worry about it. They could flaunt the law. Meanwhile, if you're that 17-year-old kid who's walking home, gets caught with a little bit of drugs, you're done. Because not only do you get arrested, now we stack mandatory minimums. I've had children sit in my office pleading with me about their stories to do something about the fact that the prosecutor said to them, and by the way, we don't have juries and judges and trials anymore. 98% of our criminal convictions are done by plea bargain. Because if you, Katie, with that 17-year-old kid sitting in my prosecutor, I can say, look, I'm going to move you to adult court. I'm going to stack your charges. You're going to face 15 years for your nonviolent crimes. Or you can plead guilty now. You can get out. I get a win. You get a felony charge. Now you can't get a job. You can't get a Pell Grant. You can't get business licenses. You can't vote. Done. And what does that 17-year-old think now? His public schools probably didn't serve him, doesn't have that great of an education. Now he's a criminal charge. What is the likelihood that they're going to recidivate and get back into trouble again? Because we're not empowering them to succeed. That's the system we have right now. It's broken in so many different ways, and it's stacked against poor people, mentally ill people, addicted people, women, people of color. And so this is the fight for me, is taking on this system in every single way. I was relentless when I was running for this office. I didn't care if you put me through the wealthiest community in New Jersey or the poorest community in New Jersey. I was talking about this issue, even though it didn't poll. It's one of the top concerns of my state. It is one of the biggest cancers on the soul of this country, and it's costing us so much money. From the time I was in law school to the time I was mayor of the city of Newark, we were building a new prison every 10 days in this country. And so if you don't think this mass incarceration, the fact that we have one out of every four incarcerated people on the planet Earth, the majority of them for nonviolent crimes, if you don't think that's hurting us as Americans with the debt that we have, you're crazy. And it's making us less safe, not more.
Let's do our quick lightning round, because I know we have to catch a train going back to New York, and you've been so generous with your time.
You guys
too,
were so
Corey.
Generous. I was late because of the protest on
that's
the Senate
okay.
floor.
That's
on the,
okay.
On the Senate steps.
It's a real treat just to have this conversation. Just quick answers, if you will. Donald Trump. Discuss. I just mean, what do you make of him and his presidency? Because every day there seems to be a new event that's causing consternation, national consternation, which kind of sounds like constipation.
I hate to say, it's a little bit of both metaphorically. Look, I think the thing that offends me the most about this presidency, if a Republican won, they would be pushing policies that I fundamentally disagree with. And that would have been a battle royale, and I would be upset about that. But I think what is making this presidency so difficult for me, for my Republicans in this Senate colleagues, is that this guy is so trashing the norms, the dignity of the office as he trashes Americans. I mean, here's a guy that's more upset about Nordstrom's dropping his daughter, tweeting about that, than he is about the Russians invading or attacking our elections.
Which
here.
He still doubts. He doubts the conclusion of
which
17
is dangerous.
Intelligence agencies.
He's kind of
agencies.
Said yes and no, and
well,
he seems to
Scaramucci,
go back and forth.
Scaramucci, the new communications director,
or
said—
Or the Mooch, as he's called.
Yes,
said that he still doubted the conclusion of these agencies.
But then that is— what he's doing is continuing to undermine institutions in our country, whether it's the press, attacking the press, our First Amendment ideals every single week, it seems. He is attacking our intelligence agencies. As a candidate, he attacked our military. I know more about this than the generals, the guy that was going to have a plan to end ISIS in his first whatever days. The Russia, when I talked to – first time I sat down with the ambassadors from Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, these are Baltic nations that border the Soviet Union. And they were saying
– Or Russia.
Excuse me. God, flashback.
You're not that old.
I'm not that old. I'm not that old. I was still in high school when we had the Soviet Union. But they border the Russians, and their warnings to us, almost like the chickens coming home to roost, like you weren't taking us seriously when we were telling you that the Russians are seeking to undermine Western democracy. And everybody I talked to in Eastern Europe when I was there said, you all need to wake up. This is how the Russians do what they call a hybrid war. Not only is there a physical conflict, but then they take us on with propaganda, with cyber attacks, trying to get people to lose faith in the information they're getting from the press, lose faith in democratic institutions, lose faith in the electoral process itself. And so if anything, the president's rhetoric is complicit in what our adversaries are trying to do, undermine our faith in democracy, weaken our election system, weaken our free press, and weaken the very institutions that he represents as president that include everything from the military to the intelligence agencies.
Listen, Mr. Yale Law school. Can the president pardon himself, pardon his family, pardon his associates, and fire Bob Mueller?
So this is, and I just wanted to take one step back on that question, because this is why I came down here with a big afro, pulled all my hair out. That's a joke.
Well, you did a very good job.
So, thank you very much.
You should have seen his afro this morning. It was unbelievable.
I never thought I would be sitting in interviews and there would come a day where questions like that would be asked, like, with a straight face. Like the fact that we are sitting here as Americans and wondering if a president can preemptively pardon himself for serious crimes is, to me, astonishing. So
serious crimes, if it's proven.
The question is, can the president preemptively pardon himself and pardon his or not even preemptively pardon himself if it's proven, pardon the people in his senior staff? This is a frightening moment for America that we have serious questions like this being asked. It was actually frightening to me, all the accusations of collusion. You know, they were denying, people were saying, for me, it was like a lot of political noise. But when I read an email where literally people are saying a foreign government wants to cooperate with your campaign to beat your opponent, and Donald Trump Jr. says, if this is real, I love it. That alone, when that email came forward, I can't tell you what their public statements were, but the conversations around this place were just stunned that you literally have a smoking gun of the intention of Donald Trump's most senior advisors seeking to collude with the Russians to even go to him. That email itself should have been turned over. And they all went to the meeting.
But do you think the drip,
talk about
drip,
a lack
drip,
of patriotism.
Do you think the drip, drip, drip has, in fact, somewhat normalized this? Because it comes so frequently and so often, it seems as if there's a kind of an explosion and then it dissipates.
What's
and
that song, I've Become Comfortably Numb? No, I am not.
No, but I don't mean for you necessarily. Yes. I just mean for the public at large. Do you think at some point they're so awash in scandal that nothing sticks in a weird way?
So this is how I know that's not true. The public at multiple points has stopped bad things from happening, more than I have as a senator. So whether it's the independent ethics oversight of the House, that was shut down by public outrage. Version 1 of the House healthcare bill, shut down by public outrage. The version 1 of the Muslim ban. I mean, I watched one of my greatest moments as an American was witnessing out at Dulles Airport all of these people chanting and cheering as Muslim families that weren't even necessarily American citizens, watching people with yarmulkes on, showing their true faith and cheering people coming out of that airport. It reminds me of the story from the Bible and the Torah of Abraham sitting there in pain and watching strangers come, and he runs to them joyously and welcomes them. I mean, this is us living our values. The Women's March. I sat down in New Jersey recently with 4 incredible women activists who weren't involved before but have been awoken by this crisis. So I'm seeing the best of America. It's just like Miss Virginia Jones. Hope is a response to despair, and they're not letting despair win. They're showing their patriotism, showing their power by engaging now like they never have before.
We're almost out of time, but we have to ask Corey, don't we, Brian, about running for president?
Well,
I'm running from the president, if you haven't heard already. I'm like, out of here.
I mean, do you rule out running for president in 2020?
So let me tell you a horrible confession, but it's out there in the public already, but I've never said it on
this
a podcast
be
before.
Cute, I know.
Yeah, well, look, I was mayor and I was trying to figure out what to do next, you know, run for reelection for a third term, run for governor, run for my life and get the heck out of politics. And a guy who is never let reporters be your friend. That's why Katie's such a threat to me. But Tom Moran is one of my favorite journalists in America. And he's just hanging out. It's the end. It's always bad at the end of an interview when you're really comfortable. You start joking. He goes, what about Senate? Would you ever run for Senate? And I unfortunately said, if I ever run for Senate, please stop me. And I invited him to do violence to me in a very grotesque way that I regret doing.
And everybody can Google.
And everybody
grotesque
can unfortunately
way
Google
that was.
The way I put that.
Blow my brains out.
And
no, it was worse.
That was worse.
Anyway.
And it wasn't off the record?
Anyway,
you've learned.
I didn't say off the record. And he, you know, this is why Tom, I have a love-hate.
And you're still friends with him?
I have a love-hate relationship with him. So because, of course, what did he roll out when I finally decided to run for Senate, and which I could not have envisioned?
He didn't do to you what you suggested he do to you.
He did not
though.
Do to me, but he did expose me for saying such a dramatic thing to never that I would never run
for
Senate.
Okay, enough preamble. You're filibustering here. Are you going to run for president
point,
or
at
not?
At this point, I cannot see it.
Yes.
I'm very intent on trying to earn a re-election in New Jersey in 2020 when I am up.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's going to be a very tough campaign for you getting re-elected
in
New Jersey.
I am taking it seriously in the time of Trump. I'm not taking anything for granted.
No, in your quiet moments of self-reflection.
Yes.
Do you think about...
I try to empty my thoughts when I'm meditating. Yeah, that's what I do. But the power of now.
Okay, after you're meditating or after you're done meditating.
And he's a vegan too, so he's probably just meditating about how much he misses
meat.
Well,
he does
drink. Who would want a vegan meditator in the White House for crying out loud?
Are you still a vegan?
I am still a vegan. I'm a lifetime vegan. It's
done. You've been a lifetime vegan.
All right,
I am now a lifetime vegan.
All right, we digress. So are there any circumstances under which you would say, you know what, I feel a patriotic duty to change, to work on all these issues in a way that I have so much power, I can really, really change things.
I will make you a deal right now. I'll make news. If you run for president, I will run as your vice president.
Oh, brother.
Why?
John, yeah.
Why?
Brian was just like,
you literally had a physical reaction to that.
It
can't be caught by a podcast, but you look nauseous.
Okay.
He's not going to answer the question. Can I ask one more thing?
I thought I answered the question.
You didn't answer
the question. I did not see myself running for president.
Yeah, okay.
Right now. Well, Cory Booker, Senator Booker, thank you so much for giving us so much time and for inviting us into your little hideaway, which is your secret office that people have here on Capitol Hill. I'm sorry there is not a full bar here.
Because
apparently some of the more senior members they're kind of tricked out with a whole bar situation.
Yes. But the Cafe Car of the Acela, I've definitely visited that at times.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, if we make our train.
Good enough for lunch, yes. Good enough for dinner.
You guys,
Cory Booker, thank you. Yeah, we better get the heck out of Dodge. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you both. I appreciate you guys being so patient too.
As usual, we want to thank our intrepid production team, including our producer, Gianna Palmer, our audio engineer, Jared O'Connell. Thanks also to Emily Bina of Katie Couric Media, that behemoth, and Nora Ritchie for her production assistance. Allison Bresnick makes things happen for social media, and we thank her for that. And thank you, as always, Mark Phillips for our theme music. Katie and I are the executive producers of this podcast.
And everybody, don't be a stranger. Email us at comments@couricpodcast.com or leave us a voicemail at 929-224-4637. We love getting your messages. Honestly, they truly make our day. You can also find us on social media anytime at all hours of the night
day
when
night,
it comes
yeah.
to me. I'm Katie Couric on Twitter and Instagram and Katie Couric on Snapchat. I'm also on Facebook, and you can find Brian on Twitter at GoldsmithB. Now, if you've listened this far, hopefully you've liked what you've heard. So let the good people at Apple Podcasts know by rating and reviewing our show there so we can keep it alive. Keep hope alive, everybody. Please subscribe as well. Anyway, thank you, as always, for listening.
Thank you very much. And from somewhere en route from D.C. to New York,
where I just ate a hot dog that's giving me serious acid indigestion.
TMI.
Tom's anyone?
Adios.
Bye.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.